everybody. Welcome to episode 476 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a Superman Sunday episode, and I have the pleasure of welcoming Adam from Talking Superman back to the show. Adam, thanks for joining me.
Great. Thank you for having me. Glad to be back.
Yeah, I'm very curious how our views of the book we're going to talk about today are going to vary. Because I know that you've kind of been a fan of what Bendis has been doing so far. I've been kind of on the fence, and this one's kind of pushing me toward the one side, and it's not the good side. So we're going to be talking about Action Comics 1002, which that still boggles my mind that there's a comic out there above 1000. So let me give the creative team really quickly, and then we'll talk briefly about our thoughts, and then I'll give a synopsis, and we'll dive a little deeper. So it's written by Brian Michael Bendis, as I mentioned. We've got art by Patrick Gleason, which is the high point for me, and colors by Alejandro Sanchez with letters by Josh Reed. So for me, when you look at the two different titles that Bendis is currently writing, he's writing Action Comics, he's writing Superman. Over in Superman, spoilers if you haven't read it, but you know, what are you waiting for? It's been weeks now, if not a month. The Earth is over in the Phantom Zone, and Superman's dealing with that. And I felt like the first issue there was great. Second issue didn't do much. It didn't advance the story much, in my opinion. But the art, again, is the high point. Yvonne Rees, spectacular art. And I am invested in that story. I do want to know what happens next. But I just felt like issue two, if you listen to Superman Sunday a couple weeks ago, you'll know this. I just felt like it was almost typical Bendis with the decompressed storyline, and it's moving a little too slow for me. So that's where I came out with Superman 2. Let me ask you real quick, Adam, what did you think? Because you weren't able to join me for that one. Superman 2, did you like it? Didn't like it?
I liked it a lot. Didn't like it as of now as much as Action, actually. But I think the a difference for me is I'm finding I think I like decompressed stories. And I'm for me, I think two to five issue arcs seem awkward to me, and I'm finding that I like the longer sort of write for the trade kind of style. So I was into it.
Yeah, there are times where I don't mind it necessarily. I think maybe part of the thing that I'm lacking, because really when you look at his Man of Steel series, that was pretty decompressed also. But I think maybe what I'm finding lacking, perhaps in the Superman title, is the fact that because the Earth is in the Phantom Zone, you can't really have, like, that's an overriding event, right? You can't really have a lot of other subplots going on, you know, whereas in, Man of Steel, I didn't necessarily mind the decompressed talk because there were a lot of different storylines going on. So maybe that's how I feel. But I agree with you that I've enjoyed Action more. I thought the first issue of Action, 1001, was spectacular. This one, I don't know. I felt a little bit, again, like a little decompression, a little slowdown, which, I was kind of okay. And then the ending, it just, yeah, it irked me, I got to say. It didn't make me mad. It didn't tick me out. Just, you know, I was not quite annoyed, but I was irked. It was just like, really? That's what you're going to do? It just didn't sit well with me. And, longtime listeners of the podcast will know this, but my wife's name is Lois. Superman's my favorite character. You know, Lois along with him. I love Lois. So to do that, to have Lois do something so out of character, yeah, I felt personally betrayed. So, but we'll get there. We'll get there. What were your initial impressions of the second issue of Action? Did you like it as much as the first?
I liked it more. I'm disappointed that you didn't like it. It was a comic that actually, like, I jumped around at a couple moments of it. I'm excited to see where it goes. I think that, with Lois particularly, obviously, yeah, that's a sore spot, and that's, you know, it's hard to argue with that, but I think, from what I've seen, I think he writes the character well, and I'm excited to hear the reasonings.
Yeah, and you know what? That might be true. Like, when I sit here and think about it, obviously we're going to go through and we'll see if this bears out. But when I sit here and think about it, I don't think at anywhere in the issue, any of the kind of nitpicky problems I had with it had anything to do with Superman, which is good when you think about it. You know, you want Bendis to get him right. I think it might have had more to do with the other subplots around it. But there was a lot to like. And I think maybe as we go through, it may even be that if the story had ended two pages sooner, I may be in that boat with you. Like, yeah, it was a great issue. But maybe I'm just, you know, because that was the taste that was left in my mouth with what happened with Lois. I was just like, oh, no, bad issue.
Yeah.
So we'll see when we go through it. So let me do the quick synopsis here. I have to say that these recap pages that Bendis is doing, and just to give you listeners a little history, Dan Didio, one of the publishers at DC, had kind of raked Marvel over the coals a few times over the years about having to do these recaps, right? Like inside the front cover of a lot of Marvel comics, you'll get a couple paragraphs that'll tell you what's been going on in the book. And Didio's always like, oh, we don't need to do that. Our writers, you know, we have really strong writers and we don't need to do that. It's, you know, in the context of the story, you can understand what's going on. We'll never do that, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, Bendis coming over from years at Marvel, I guess I don't want to say he's relying on it or it's a crutch, but I think it's just something that he likes to use. So they've done it a little
bit. May I ask a question about that?
Yeah, go ahead.
I was wondering about it because I actually haven't heard that before I started listening to your podcast. I was interested in that. And was... Is DC against, or Dan Didio against recap like paragraphs, or is he against recaps in panels? Like, you know what I mean? Like, is it in theory better here because it's just a couple boxes in the backdrop of a new page instead of redoing, you know, scenes?
So in my mind, the big driving reason behind this is when you take the inside front cover, put the credits on it, and then have a recap and whatever else, you know, your indice and all that stuff. Then you just lost a page that you could sell for advertising. So in my mind, that's kind of the driving force behind not wanting it inside the front cover. And then if you do it as, you know, one of the regular pages, now the creative team has lost a page to tell the story, right? So in my mind, that's kind of where it's being editorially driven, where, hey, we don't want to give up an advertising space. You can take one of your story pages and do it if you want. And as the years have gone by, creative teams, you know, have been squeezed on real estate, you know, more and more as, you know, prices go up, inflation, printing, coloring, you know, all that kind of stuff, all contributes to the fact that we have fewer pages now. So they're not going to really want to give up a page. And I feel like a lot of the creators over there, they're not necessarily big enough that it's like, oh, this is a hill that I want to die on, right? Like, I want to be insistent. Somebody like Scott Snyder could do it, right? But oftentimes his stuff is so tightly plotted and leads from one issue to the next anyway, that as long as you're following along, you don't really need the recap, but also his stories aren't really ones you can jump in the middle anyway. You've got to go back and start at the beginning. So in that case, the recap's not necessarily needed. Bendis, on the other hand, again, I think he's used it for so many years that he kind of has that feeling where I want anybody to be able to jump on any issue of my book. And as their first issue, right? They don't necessarily have to track down previous issues if they weren't able to get their hands on them. So that's my speculation. Obviously, I don't know for sure. And obviously, Bendis is a big enough name that he can go to Didio and go, I'm going to do this, you know? But of course, the sales numbers on these books haven't been necessarily what DC expected. And, you know, based on the sweetheart deal that Bendis got, I don't know how happy they are, but it still is early days. So I don't, obviously, since I've been reading all the Bendis stuff, I don't really need the recap. I don't even think I read the recap paragraphs in this issue, but I have to say that I've really enjoyed the art on the pages. Like this one, just to tell you listeners, if you didn't get the book, it's basically just like last issue, 1000, Action Comics 1001. It's basically like Clark Kent's desk, which is kind of messy, as you would expect a, you know, working, very busy reporter to be. And it's got little post-its, like, you know, along the top shelf, all around the edges of his monitor. Within the monitor screen itself is all the name of the issue and the creative team and everything. But you go and you read these notes. There's one that says, for example, Black Label Pitch, Red Tornado Year One. Well, hey, I would love to read a Red Tornado Year One Black Label title. Let me tell you, that would be awesome. We've also got one that says Jim Lee called. Another one has LexCorp's main number. Another one says to return Bruce's wedding gift. Obviously, Batman 50, him and Catwoman didn't get married. Yeah, it's really cool to see all these different little in jokes. I think, isn't there one? Oh, yeah, remind Bendis eye appointment. So
yeah, eye appointment.
Yeah, they're just fun. They're just fun. So, you know, like I said, I don't need the recap myself, didn't read it, but I appreciate the kind of the little in jokes here. So I don't necessarily mind the recap page at all necessarily. This to me is more interesting doing a recap page like this, because you could even, you know, when you go around and read those little notes, some of those even could be little in story Easter eggs, right? And so when you do it like this, rather than just, you know, a page inside the front cover that just has a couple paragraphs and doesn't have anything necessarily to do with the story, at least doing it like this, it gives the opportunity to hide little things or hint at things to come. So I really kind of enjoy it. What are your thoughts on that, Adam?
I've also been kind of skimming the actual recap panels, but I really love how the first page really sets a tone. Like in Superman, the first page is flying in space, and for Action, the first two have been office desks. I think that's a really good kind of immediately letting you know what the mission is for the book.
Yeah, that's a good point, because the two Action issues we've gotten so far have been pretty heavily focused on Metropolis, you know, not Daily Planet, yes, but also the broader world of Metropolis, whereas in Superman so far it's really been kind of cosmic. So you're right. Yeah. They're definitely setting the tone. So let me give the quick synopsis. It starts off, we're in Metropolis. Yeah. We're outside, and a body's dropped from the sky. It turns out that it's Yogurt, who we met last issue, one of the gangsters who was actually responsible for setting the fires. And then the scene switches to inside the Daily Planet, and we see Perry White kind of giving the business to Ms. Good about she wrote an article that said Superman drops gangster to his death. And she explains to Perry that, it was Yogurt. He was a gangster. And Perry's like, okay. And Superman dropped a low-level criminal to his death in the broad daylight in front of children. And Miss Good's like, yes. Perry's like, well, at the same time, he supposedly was with the Justice League in Seattle fighting a giant starfish. And we've got pictures of that. We don't have any pictures of him dropping this gangster. And Miss Good's like, hey, I'm just here to report the news. I love Perry says, he goes, good, then go find some, because this ain't it. And she tries to argue. And he says, look, I've got photos that say Superman was in Coast City. I've got nothing that shows him dropping bodies in Midtown. And her response is, so all these people are lying? He says, go find out, you know, like a reporter. So clearly there's some kind of ulterior motive. You know, we've seen her be kind of shady in the past. We don't know that much yet, but we do learn some things in this particular issue. But yeah, it's almost like she's trying to start a smear campaign against Superman. So as Perry turns around, Clark Kent is there. He's asking what that was about. And Perry's response is Yogurt, Kent. You do have to give it to Bendis. He is really, really good. Maybe one of the best at dialogue. And Clark's response is, you want me to go get you some? He's like, no, a low-level criminal goes by Yogurt. So Clark's up to speed. He's like, oh, so the thing in Midtown? Perry says, yeah, find out. Clark says, find out more. Find out what? And Perry's like, find out more. And Clark doesn't want to do it. He's like, that's Miss Good's story. I don't, you know. Perry's like, I want a second look. He reluctantly agrees. You can tell he's not happy. And when in response to Clark saying that that's unusual, Perry says, well, that's not really true because I had Lois Lane do it to your stories all the time, which is hilarious when you think about it. So Clark glances over his shoulder at Miss Good as she goes storming off. And you can tell by the look on his face because he knows he wasn't there in Metropolis in Midtown dropping this guy. So what's her story, right? You can tell he looks pretty suspicious. Great job by Patrick Gleason to convey that look from Clark. He looks so different from Superman. But yet, you know it's him. I think Gleason's one of the best at drawing Clark Kent. But yeah, just look on his face, like you can tell his suspicions are aroused. So then we move to the back of a limo where Boss Moxie is talking to the guy that we met last issue. He's kind of the IT guy, the tech guy with all the screens. He's able to tell the group, the cabal, I'll call it, last issue, when Superman's out of town, so they know that they can do things. And he's trying to get the information for Boss Moxie. Moxie's not really being patient. Finally, he states to, yeah, he's gone. He's like, all right, thank you. See, that wasn't so hard. And then Boss Moxie's whole entire limo is attacked, and he pretty much has the crap beat out of him, and it's the Guardian. And this is a new look for the Guardian, as far as I know. I don't remember seeing him in quite – it's almost like Iron Man armor that he's wearing. So as he's trying to get some answers from Boss Moxie about him and his crew and wondering why they're not all in jail, we see Red Cloud show back up. But everything else happens off panel. So then the scene shifts to Metropolis General Hospital, where the Guardian is after being raked over the coals, let's say, by Red Cloud. And Maggie Sawyer and the MCU shows up, or MSC, Metropolis Special Crimes, whatever they're calling it this month. And so they find out from the Guardian that it was somebody named Red Cloud that did this to him, because they assume Boss Moxie's dead, and they assume it was the Guardian that did it. But the medical examiner says, no, Boss Moxie's dead in the basement with a couple of bumps and bruises, but there's nothing on his body that says the Guardian laid a hand on him. So they find, they hear the name Red Cloud. If that actually means anything to any of them, it's not shown. I kind of doubt it, because, Red Cloud kind of got introduced in Bendis's first action issue, but it'll be interesting to see. We know next to nothing about her still. Then the scene shifts to a bar. Clark Kent has gone slumming to find out information about Yogurt and what's going on. He reports back to Perry. He says, yeah, Yogurt, the dead guy in Midtown, he was the one that lit the fires. And according to the people that would know, he lit the fires because, as he put it, when there was a big fire in the city, Superman would get preoccupied with that, and they'd be able to go hit a good score, whether it's weapons or drugs or whatever, right? So Perry's kind of surprised. He's like, wow, these suicide slum gangsters were lighting buildings of people on fire just to distract Superman. He's like, that's some Gotham City level psychotic, sociopathic nightmare there. And I love this. Perry's like, if I were Superman, I'd fold this entire city up like a quesadilla. It's like, wait, what, Perry, what are you talking about? So I will say Bendis I really like his take on Perry White. He's gruff, he's wise, yeah, but he's also wisecracking. So it's pretty interesting. And then Clark excuses himself, and Perry's like, I want to hear the rest. And Clark's like, hold on, I forgot, I got to go somewhere. And the next page we see he flies off into space, into the asteroid belt. So apparently he had, he'd found out the information from Yogurt's, his underlings or colleagues or whatever you want to call it. Superman, Clark Kent, immediately went to report to Perry. And now that he's kind of reiterated and relayed the information he got, I think it's starting to sink in. And it angers him. It angers him. So he flies out to the asteroid belt and punches some asteroids and vents that anger. This is an interesting take on Superman, and we'll talk a little more about it later. Like, in the past, it's always been, no, he's Superman. He's able to just kind of deal with that, right? Internalize things that, the horrors that he sees and kind of come to grips with it by the fact that he does so much good. Here we see him kind of let loose some of that pent up frustration that he's not always able to solve the problems and to figure things out. And he, in a way, this is almost the most human that we've ever seen Superman. He has lost his temper, but he's still Superman, and he's smart enough to make sure to go somewhere where he won't do any harm if he cuts loose. But it is a very interesting concept to think about. So as Clark returns to the Daily Planet, Kat Gratt shows up, and apparently she has her own magazine now. I think that's where she is with her status quo. So she says hi to Clark and slips that she has seen kind of the first excerpts from Lois's book. And Clark's like, whose book? He's like, Lois's book. It's really good. I only got a peek, but I can tell she's on fire. And Clark's like, Lois Lane's book? Kat says, yeah. Clark's response is, she finished her book? And the cat realizes that she messed up. The cat's out of the bag, right? Pun intended. She's like, oh, I swear I thought, I'm sorry. And Clark's like, how would I, he's completely lost. And Kat's like, I'm really sorry. Didn't mean to bring up a sore spot, whatever's going on with you guys. Sorry. And then she moves on to talk to Perry, and Clark's there looking at a picture of him and Lois and John. So meanwhile, we see Miss Good meeting with Mr. Strong, who is head of that cabal, or seems to be head of that cabal that we got introduced to last issue. So clearly she is not on the up and up. Clearly she's, not on the side of angels. And they're talking about the fact that, Miss Good underestimated Perry White. You know, she thought she would just be able to start this smear campaign in the Daily Planet. By saying Superman killed a guy, and it obviously didn't go her way. She says, Perry White is not the chump I first thought him. And Mr. Good's like, well, he's been at it a long time. And so Mr. Tong's like, well, do you need to be pulled out? She's like, no, after everything I put into this, it's perfect. I know exactly what I need to do. And she has written on a piece of paper, because obviously if you say the word kryptonite in Metropolis, you're probably going to get the attention of Superman. It says, I want a piece of kryptonite. And again, Bendis kind of shows his flair for snappy dialogue. He's like, Mr. Strong's like, I have one right here in my pocket. Like, what are you talking about? Kryptonite, like, come on. But he does say that it's where she grew up. It's where I grew up. It's our home, referring to Metropolis. The other guy, referring to Superman, is not from here. He came here. Why should we leave? So clearly, they're kind of in that Lex Luthor mindset, right? Like, he's the outsider. He's the one that doesn't belong. And so they have employed Miss Good, it appears, to take out Superman. And why she's suited for that, or why she has the ability to do that, we haven't learned. But she wants the kryptonite for a little bit of insurance. And although we don't know who this mysterious woman is, I mean, I don't know if they're referring to Red Cloud or someone else, because Miss Good says she's here in the room, and Mr. Strong responds, she's listening. He's like, okay, well, it's just a little insurance. The kryptonite's just a little insurance. So meanwhile, they talk about the fact that the only reason that anyone on Earth even knows about kryptonite is because Superman himself told a reporter, told Lois Lane. And Good's like, yeah, that's true, but we don't say her name either, because obviously saying the name Lois Lane also could get the attention of Superman. And Miss Good's like, yeah, I know that, but I was just thinking, what does it feel like to have that kind of dude wrapped around your little finger? Obviously referring to Lois's ability to, I don't want to say manipulate Superman, but have him in her corner, so to speak. So then the scene shifts to a blonde woman walking on the street, complaining about the hamburger she just bought having pickles despite her asking for no pickles. And we see Superman fly up behind her, say, Lois? She's got a look on her face like, uh-oh. She turns around, takes the wig off. It is Lois. We see the dark hair, and her response is, "Hi, honey." So, yeah, apparently that was Lois on the final page of Action Comics 1001, despite, I think I said it was Trish Q. That's what I assumed, because she was writing what looked to be like a tell-all of Superman. So why is Lois back? Where is John? And why would she come back without letting Superman know? And then we've got the blurb for next issue, Kryptonite Baby. So, yeah, where do you want to start, Adam? Because there's a lot to unpack here.
Yeah, you're right. Well, I guess, we'll talk about Lois first, okay. I guess, because, you know, that's the seemed to be your main issue. I was just thinking, I was wondering if this is going to be a way of Bendis to explore that, like, hey, you know, this relationship is, it's a good relationship, but you can't really say that it was built on honesty with the whole, you know, lying about being Superman for so long. I'm wondering if this is going to be a story kind of exploring that aspect.
Yeah, that's interesting because it's so far back in the past when you think about it in terms of, I mean, what was it, 92 when Jurgens finally wrote the issue where Superman told, or Clark Kent told, hey, I'm Superman. That famous issue where, you know, it's Lois with the surprised look on her face and you see the glasses coming off in the foreground. So yeah, that's interesting. I guess from my perspective, it's just been so long and their relationship seems to be one that has had like honesty at the center of it for so long. And also, I think a lot of it because they have gone through so much. You know, Lois is probably, in a way, the character in the DCU who's been endangered more times than anyone and yet has always come through, despite the fact she has no superpowers, because of her close relationship. So her and Clark, Superman, especially considering this is the pre-Flashpoint Superman, those two have come through so much together that they're so close. They trust each other implicitly, I feel like, where they are in their relationship right now. And that's why this just didn't sit well with me, because I feel like they're so far past this. I mean, my gut reaction is that, okay, well, Lois didn't want to tell Clark she was back because out there on that trip through the galaxy with Jor-El, she came to the realization, or became obvious to her, that where John belonged for now was with Jor-El, and she couldn't stay out there indefinitely because she was probably only slowing them down. And she kind of had to make that decision on her own because she was no longer able to communicate with Clark, because the communication device got destroyed by Rogel Zar when he attacked the Fortress of Solitude. So she was worried about what Clark's reaction would be, because she basically left her son out there with a mass murderer. So that's my gut. That's my gut of why she would do it. And she was fearful of that. But again, that logically, that makes sense in my head, but it doesn't make sense that she would think that, like, oh, I'm going to hide out and not let him know. And she, yeah, that thought would last about 3 seconds. Because they just share everything. And so I guess maybe it's not so much that Bendis is doing this and kind of, in my mind, disparaging Lois, just so much as it's inconsistent with the Clark-Lois relationship we've seen for the last, and again, this is the pre-Flashpoint Clark and Lois, so, you know, you'll have to cut out those 5 years of New 52, because obviously that was a different Clark and a different Lois that had a much different relationship. But if you take out that little window of time there, we're talking at like 20 years, if not longer, 25 years of Clark and Lois relationship, where it was very honest and close, and they shared everything for the most part. So that's kind of why it bothers me, just the inconsistency. But again, the jury's still out. If Bendis has every chance to change my mind, if it turns out that it's a great story reason that makes a lot of sense, then, you know, maybe I could get on board with it. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're right. Definitely. I too am struggling to think of a reason. that would justify it. Maybe because she is seeking more independence. I think that a lot of people would say that's in her character, but even that is, you know, like you said, they've been together for so long. I think I'm going to be patient with the reasoning. I don't want to speculate too much. Are you at least happy that she's back so soon?
I am happy she's back so soon. But that's like, if I had a choice between her being back so soon and doing this crappy thing to Superman and having her come back later and not do the crappy thing, I think I'd rather would have had her come back later. But again, it's all dependent on what actually happens. You know, something else I just thought about though is, you know, going back to the New 52 Lois and the New 52 Superman, she did betray him. There was that storyline as well, because she thought she was doing him a favor. So if Bendis can come up with that kind of twist for this, then maybe that would work.
Yeah. If she thinks that what she's doing is good for her family, yeah. But I just can't think of what that would be, but
yeah,
we'll see.
But maybe that's why DC doesn't pay us to write the book, because Bendis is a better idea guy than us.
Right.
It's possible. It's possible. All right. Let's, let's work backward. Why not? Right. So we started with the Lois, which, yeah, jury's still out. But my gut reaction, I'm telling you, like, this is it. So I read it once and then obviously flipped through it before we started recording and then went through with the synopsis. It has bothered me less each time. I will say that the initial shock of it really, really got to me. But what do we think about?
My initial thing was interest, and I definitely see how initially it would be, you know, what the hell.
Yeah, and maybe if my wife's name wasn't Lois, maybe it wouldn't bother me as much either. How dare you betray me? What do we think about Miss Good? I'm having a tough time seeing her as, like, when she first got introduced in the DC Nation Zero story, I was like, oh, cool, you know, another, you know, reporter like Ron Troop, Jimmy Olsen style, you know, part of the team. Clearly she's not that, but I'm not necessarily buying her as this like despicable, manipulative, like fixer kind of person. I don't know. Kind of don't know what to think yet.
I like her. I think it's interesting because it seems to me like the organization going after Superman is, they think, on one hand, we have Red Cloud, who can take him on possibly physically, but we need the other side where we have Ms. Good, who can take him on public perception-wise. And it's a good way, I think, to make journalism in a comic book interesting in the context of Metropolis.
Yeah, that's true. Although I feel like the trope of bad PR for superheroes has been kind of done to, you know, kind of like Spider-Man, you know, hero or menace kind of thing. So yeah, I guess it'll be interesting. And I always thought Superman, hasn't he really been all kind of above that? It's part of the what I don't like about Snyder's Man of Steel movie, about where people are questioning. Yeah. You know, it's like, man, can he just be the one guy who's kind of above reproach? Can he just be the one guy that everybody, you know, the general public loves, and he's always out there putting his neck on the line? And so I don't know. I mean, again, it's to be seen if a smear campaign would if she'd even be able to get it off the ground, or if it would even work.
I absolutely agree. And I think that what I love about Bendis so far is I think he's actively against that. That's why Perry White, every time this happened with the fires, with the dropping the gangster, it gets shut down very fast. It's not really a story about the public turning against them. It's a story about Superman versus lies.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. That really goes back to the very beginning of the character, when, you know, he used to take on slumlords and, you know, propaganda and all that kind of stuff, fighting for the underdog, the little man, really is a hero of the people, so to speak.
Yeah.
What do we think about Superman flying out to space to cut loose? I'm of two minds about it. I find it super interesting that no one's ever kind of shown this before, and we are seeing that, man, he really does have emotion. But then at the same time, there's a little part of me, and it's definitely the minority. I'd say like 90% enjoy this scene and this part of the story. And I think it's really cool for Bendis to do this. But then there's that little part of me that goes, man, I don't want Superman to lose his temper, because he's supposed to be like better than us, right? And I lose my temper, you know, but I want Superman to be better than me and to be able to not lose his temper. That's part of what makes him, you know, such a great character. So, but for the most part, I think it's cool. I think it's interesting to watch him cut loose like this. And really, it does make him more relatable in a way.
Yeah. Well, it reminded me actually of I think it has been done once or twice, but it reminded me of the time Luther became president. He went out, cut a moon in half.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
Yeah. But yeah, I think that Superman should be allowed to be angry at times. But I like it actually better manifested here as going out and punching meteors than it is mostly manifest as staring down bad guys with laser eyes. And I like that there were one or two panels in this scene that showed more of a little more docile, a little more tranquil panels in there, to show that it's not just anger, he's sad about something. I think it's less about what's going on in Metropolis, more about the tensions building up with his family.
Yeah, I think it's all of it, really.
Yeah.
Because when we talk about the fires, that is another little nitpick that I had. It was such a huge thing in the Man of Steel 6-issue miniseries. You know, the way they built it up, these fires, and, you know, brought Batman in to try to, you know, get some clues. And you're telling me that Batman, these fires were just started by these street level thugs, and Batman couldn't find clues and track it. He would have solved that in like 10 minutes, I feel like. But they built it up in the 6-issue. To seem like it was so important and it was such a big thing and it was probably some new character we'd never seen before. I mean, that's the impression that I got. And then just to find out that it was just, oh, it's just these street level guys that were doing it to distract Superman while they went and robbed other stuff. It's very anticlimactic in a way, in my opinion. What do you think?
I get that. I think that I'm interested in these guys. That didn't really upset me. That I get where you're coming from. I just haven't thought about that like that before.
I mean, maybe if this cabal is as powerful as they appear to be, maybe they can start fires like this or whatever and get away with it kind of undetected. And it does seem to be, you know, part of their larger, you know, organization to be able to do all this stuff right underneath Superman's nose. I find that very interesting, that this criminal empire is finding a way to not only survive, but thrive. And it makes sense. You know, of course, they'd have a monitoring station to know when he was out of town, you know, as soon as he leaves Metropolis, so they can, you know, get their nefarious deeds done. It reminds me very much of Court of Owls from Scott Snyder's Batman run. So I don't know. And the fact that Yogurt was kind of doing it on his own, and he ended up paying the price for that.
That was an interesting thing, I think, because the explanation for the fires wasn't just that the organization was doing it. It was kind of that you notice now because Yogurt was doing it too much. I think did they say something like that in Action?
Yeah.
1000. Yeah. I think that to me, I think wasn't a satisfying explanation.
Yeah, he was doing it too much, and then by blaming it on Superman, it actually brought more of Superman's attention, like more of a danger of Superman's attention being on the cabal, when really what they're trying to do is lay low. So I don't know. I wonder if this was Bendis's original idea for these fires, or if it changed over time, because it did seem to start off as such a huge plot point, and it kind of, you know, kind of ended with a whimper, but maybe it's going to lead into something else. You know, maybe this particular, I mean, obviously we're not done with the cabal, but maybe the fires and Chief Melody Moore and all that, you know, there's more to come with that. So that would make sense. Let's see, scrolling back a little farther here. It was nice to see the Guardian back, looking very formidable. But he seemed to be a little bit more kind of aggressive, almost a Punisher-like than I remember ever seeing him before. Did you find that to be true?
Could he flip a car before?
Yeah, I don't think he was that strong.
Yeah, I was trying to think about that. I didn't even notice that you mentioned he had a more of a mechanical suit. I didn't even notice that. I'll have to look back. But, yeah, he was very angry, and that didn't bother me too much because it seemed like he had some history with this gang.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't mind him being a little more aggressive. You know, I it wasn't that I ever disliked the Guardian. I always thought that even when he showed up in the pages of Superman, he always still felt like a Golden Age character to me. You know,
yeah.
And not that this is true, but it's just kind of the perception we have looking back on, you know, at the period of time of the 30s and 40s, where we think it was things were a little more civilized, and you know, criminals weren't quite as dangerous or whatever. And again, I don't think that's actually true in reality, but it's just us looking back, you know, oh, the awesome days of yesteryear when things were simpler, you know. And so he was a bit more of a generic two-dimensional character. And I think even when they brought him into more of the modern Superman comics, he still had that kind of vanilla feel. And again, it wasn't that I ever disliked him. It just didn't feel like there was a lot to his personality. You know, he was just kind of Jim Harper, the Guardian do-gooder, you know, goody two shoes kind of guy. So I actually like that Bendis is giving him an edge here, because I think it makes him a more interesting character, right?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I've always kind of thought of it as, I thought when they introduced Gangbuster, I thought that was an improvement from the Guardian, but I don't think that you could use Gangbuster to be, I've always seen him as a little bit more softer, you know, violence-wise. And if Bendis wants to use a violent, you know, street-level thing, Guardian is a good character, I think, to use that for.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And yet to be seen what Red Cloud is. Although the one thing I'd say about Red Cloud, I mean, we haven't even really gotten a good visual yet. Unless that visual is what we're getting, you know, that she literally is just a red cloud with glowing eyes, which is entirely possible, I suppose. The other thing that we had that I wanted to mention was Perry's, and you kind of touched on it already, just Perry's going to shut down Miss Good every time unless he has like incontrovertible proof that Superman has done something wrong. And even then, he's probably going to give him the benefit of the doubt, like, oh, he's being mind controlled, or it's an illusion, or it's some kind of doppelganger or whatever. So I love that Perry is such a staunch supporter of Superman. And then in a broader aspect, and again, we touched on this at the beginning also, I just love the fact that this Action Comics title is kind of Metropolis and even, you know, getting more granular, Daily Planet focused. Because we did hear Bendis talk a lot when he was giving interviews and panels and such before the book started coming out about how much he respects the profession of journalism and how important he thinks journalism is in our current, you know, political climate and state of the world, with these people out there, you know, trying to discover the truth. And just it's very much a kind of a noble profession in his mind, and how much he wanted to focus on that. So and the other thing is, it does kind of harken me back to the Triangle era of Superman, when the books went from week to week to week, all tied together very closely. And because it was one narrative, there was a kind of more space to kind of build the supporting cast. So we got a lot of supporting cast of other reporters, and there was a lot of Daily Planet centric stories during that era, which, you know, that's kind of my wheelhouse of reading Superman. So I enjoyed that as well. So yeah, I think all in all, even though I'm nitpicking here and there, I guess there was more to enjoy here than there was to dislike, especially when you do it by percentage of pages, because it's only those last couple pages So yeah, I guess I did like it more than I realized, which I kind of had a feeling once I looked back through it, that might be the case.
Yeah, and hopefully, you know, 6 issues down when we get an explanation. Maybe by saying 1004, I think you said, is supposed to be the relationship with Lois and Clark focused issue. Hopefully something there will tip you a little bit more on the positive side.
Yeah, I am really looking forward to – I haven't read a ton of Bendis. Most of the Bendis stuff I've read is Ultimate Spider-Man. And even there, though, I don't ever really remember him doing an issue where it was almost all talking heads. There's always action in his issues, which, you know, for the most part, that's what you want in a comic. But every once in a while, having the characters you really care about just interact with each other can really be really interesting, too. And especially with his flair for dialogue. Like, I if that's the case, if 1004, because I hadn't heard that, if issue 1004 is focused on Clark and Lois kind of sitting down and hashing out what's going on, I greatly look forward to that then for sure. If only to see him, you know, script that dialogue.
Yeah.
The other thing that of course we have to mention, I did mention it before, is the art. In this issue, Patrick Gleason, man, he's really stepped up his game. And it's not that I thought at any point during his run with Peter J. Tomasi, where he was both writing and handling some of the art duties, his art there was spectacular as well. So I'm not saying that that art was bad and this is better. What I'm saying is that art was awesome and this art is even better. I feel like his narrative story, his sequential storytelling has gotten a little tighter. We see some really cool montage pieces in this issue. And I already mentioned what a great job I think he does with facial expressions, especially when, you know, Clark was given that side eye to Miss Good. So, absolutely no problem with the art at all. I think it's spectacular. And not just from Patrick Gleason, but also I think the color work is done really, really well. As opposed to Superman with, I think it's Alex Sinclair on colors, that is very much a primary color palette, which kind of suits the cosmic superhero sort of tone of a Superman title. This one with, you know, the Daily Planet and more of kind of street level villains, it's a little more gritty and the colors here are a little more muted. They're not quite as bright. And again, it helps to set the tone, you know, when you think like, telling a story about, you know, a newsroom or crime, newspaper down on street level, you would expect it to be a little, you know, a little more subdued, a little more gritty. And I think Alejandro Sanchez, the colorist, does an excellent job of capturing that by using a more muted palette. Plus the scenes where Superman flies into space and destroys those rocks. A lot of that art is actually the colorist, you know, putting in like the stars in the background and the lens flares from the sun and all that. So, I mean, there's particularly one where Superman's just kind of floating there after he's busted up these rocks, and you get a lens flare from the sun behind, and you get kind of a refractive, almost full circle in front of him. It's just a gorgeous looking piece of art. So kudos to the entire art team. Great job.
Yeah, agreed. I think major credit to the colorist, Alejandro Sanchez. I think I'm finding too, maybe that the tighter conversations really is a good way for Gleason to do things.
Yeah, that doesn't. Yeah, I don't disagree with that at all. I think that's 100% true. And man, I'm looking at that that image of him floating there in space behind him. I'm thinking, man, I would really like that as a print, because I would totally frame that and hang it on the wall of my studio. It's awesome looking. So, all right. Well, I think I've said all I need to about this issue. Adam, you have anything else to add?
Just that I hope it convinces you soon. And yeah, you can be enjoying this as much as I am.
Yeah, you know, I hope so too. I hope I come around to it. But at the same time, I like that we don't exactly see eye to eye on it, because it makes for good discussion points between us. instead of us both just gushing over it. But the other thing is that I bring up things that then you're, you know, the way you see it then makes me think, oh, maybe I got it wrong, which I felt that way when you came on the first time to talk about Man of Steel. And I still need to go back and I need to go back and listen to the episode we recorded to have it fresh in my mind, like the things that you pointed out, because I remember at the time thinking, oh, I didn't look at it that way. And then as soon as I finished listening to that episode, I need to go back and reread Man of Steel 6 and see if I can come around to your way of thinking on it. But I will say this about Bendis. He's got more people talking about Superman than have been in a really long time, and that's a good thing.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Adam and I both want to thank you all for joining us. Please tell your friends about us. Subscribe and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on iTunes. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available there, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So thanks for joining us, everybody, and we'll talk to you next time.